Hello, this is Ms. Dell with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated Monday, April 20th, 2026. We will begin today's reading on the front page with an article headlined, Kites, Spirits Flying High, Kiwanis Helps Kids Take to the Skies, Make Their Mark. April is Kite Flying Month. However, 10-year-old Joshua Knight didn't know about the special holiday when he visited Kite Day on Saturday in Sinewick Park in Decatur. "I wanted a free kite," he said. As a fan of kite flying, Joshua offered words of advice. "Keep the kite up high to get the wind underneath it," he said, "so it flies really high." He added, "This is good kite flying weather. It's pretty windy, so it could make a kite go pretty high." Joshua's mom, Raquel Knight, said she wanted her son to have an enjoyable spring day despite the sudden 30-degree difference in temperatures. "Yesterday would have been perfect, but that's okay," she said about the kite-flying conditions. According to members of the local Kiwanis clubs, as long as you have a good wind, springtime is the perfect time to fly a kite. The Early Bird and Golden K Kiwanis Clubs, as well as the Hickory Point Bank and Decatur Park District, hosted Kite Day on Saturday, offering free kites and snacks to families stopping by. According to Karen Savillas, Golden K Kiwanis member, "The Kiwanis Clubs are known for their dedication to helping children. That's the Kiwanis goal, to help kids," she said. "We try to help a lot of different organizations." Kite Day is one of the events that is just as popular as the member with the members as it is with the community. "We have a fun day," Savillas said. Along with a chance to color and fly a kite, the volunteers provided free ice cream, popcorn, and water. The children had a choice of two kite designs. "They're putting their own stamp on it," Savillas said about the decorating. "Then they go out there and fly them." Jenna McClellan and her three children have attended Kite Day in the past. "We're doing things that people in the community do," she said. "It gets them active and outdoors." Coloring the kites turned out to be a challenge with the wind trying to scoop them up before they were completed. However, the family didn't seem to mind. "We've never colored them before, so this is new and exciting," McClellan said. Next on the front page, ComEd power demand to double. The House committee got an overview last week of how data centers are driving up energy demand and threatening potential shortfalls in the second of three planned hearings on the matter. The fundamental issue is that data centers have created a sudden and massive spike in demand for electricity, and Illinois doesn't yet have a supply to accommodate it. There is more demand pending in the customer connection queue than they traditionally had on the system, period. So that gives you some sense of the magnitude of the challenge that we're facing, Brian Granahan, director of the Illinois Power Agency, told the House Executive Committee. Representatives from Ameren and Commonwealth Edison, Illinois, major electric supply companies, said the majority, though not all, of the large load projects in their queues are data centers, and the expected demand will be significant. "If all the projects in our pipeline come to be and they'll all reach their maximum requested demand, we'll more than double our system," took us 120 years to achieve roughly by 2040, said Max Lichtman, the director of economic and workforce development at ComEd. However, he said that projected load will come online over time and likely be in place by 2040 or 2045. "I think that's important and valuable from the utilities planning perspective because it allows us to build in stages and evaluate," Lichtman said. Brad Teets, Midwest Director of State Policy for the Data Center Coalition, said, "Data centers are becoming more energy efficient because the technology is still developing. Because Illinois has struggled to get more electricity generation to the grid," Granahan said, "provisions from the 2025 Clean and Reliable Grid Affordability Act, or CRGA, will be crucial to support this new demand. That law gives the IPA more authority to pursue generation. There Then there's a number of other initiatives from CRGA that either reduce demands, like energy efficiency programs, or otherwise make better use of something like rooftop solar or virtual power plant program, and budget changes that allow us to have more latitude to pursue additional generation, he said. House Leader Robin Gable asked if the state has the tools to build more energy supply. Granahan said that while IPA is assessing whether the deadline for closing gas and coal plants is viable, it's also assessing the regulatory and legal barriers for new nuclear power following Governor J.B. Pritzker's executive order aimed at spurring nuclear development after CRGA ended a long-standing moratorium on new plant construction. But any new supply options would take time to implement. New wind and solar farms take roughly 3 to 4 years to come online after a contract is signed, and the state is unlikely to invest in new natural gas production, Granahan said. The CRGA also creates new virtual power plant programs. That program allows homes and businesses with solar panels or wind turbines to pool energy together, acting virtually like a power plant, despite not physically existing as one. The idea is that the energy stored in residential and business batteries can be contributed to the grid during peak hours. Homes and businesses who contribute to the grid will be paid for their energy. The things that can be stood up more quickly tend to be more diffuse solutions, he said, and that's why the virtual power plant program is really important, because we can stand up these things at a smaller scale and manage peak demand through something like rooftop solar coupled with on-site batteries. The key provision of the Power Act, the main proposal for regulating data centers, is a requirement that data center companies invest in renewable energy to power their facilities. According to advocates, the main incentive of that requirement is that these companies will be allowed to come online faster and potentially beat their competitors. Data centers have major monetary costs. Sarah Moskowitz, the executive director of Citizens Utility Board, said the Power Act's requirement that data centers be put in their own rate class is another important cost control measure. If the growth continues, we're seeing estimates that in the next 24 years, the costs of serving these facilities could reach between $24 and $37 billion here in the state of Illinois for up to a $70 a month in a typical bill, she said. To help mitigate costs for customers, Lichtman said Con Ed designs rate structures so that customers with high demands are not charged with customers who have smaller demands. In March, the Illinois Commerce Commission allowed Con Ed to increase the amount of money it charges large load project developers looking to pull from the state's electric grid. Eric Whitfield, the director of economic development for Ameren, said his company is looking to do something similar, although it already has some consumer protections. Large load projects do not move forward unless detailed engineering reviews confirm the system can serve them safely, he said. If a large customer needs new or upgraded infrastructure, Whitfield said, Ameren also requires them to pay for it. A complicating factor when it comes to price is that Illinois is part of a network of regional transmission organizations, which sets the wholesale price of electricity. We have to look beyond Illinois, but we have to start with our policies here, Representative Ann Williams, Democrat Chicago, said. The bottom line is the cost increase should be isolated to the cost causers, and so how to make that happen is the challenge. The final data center hearing focused on water will be on Wednesday, April 22nd. Capital News Illinois is a Our next article on the front page, Forceful Pope Steps Onto World Stage. Pope Leo has debuted a new forceful speaking style on his four-nation Africa tour this past week, issuing sharp denunciations of war and inequity that have sparked repeated attacks on the pontiff from the U.S. President Donald Trump. The charge in rhetoric reflects Leo's growing concern with the direction of global leadership, experts say, after he maintained a relatively low profile for a pope during his first 10 months of his papacy. Trump first attacked Leo as terrible on Sunday in an apparent response to the Pope's criticisms of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. He lobbed more criticism again on Thursday, suggesting the Pope didn't understand foreign policy issues. The first U.S. Pope, speaking earlier that day in Cameroon, had said the world was being ravaged by a handful of tyrants without naming individuals. Normally, popes and the Vatican are cautious when it comes to international policies and politics, preferring diplomacy to public censure, said John Thavis, a retired Vatican correspondent who covered three papacies. Leo seems convinced that the world needs to hear explicit condemnation of injustice and aggression, and he seems aware that he is one of the very few people who have a global pulpit. The Pope, known for choosing his words carefully, mostly avoided comment about the U.S. until March, when he emerged as an outspoken critic of the Iran war. He first mentioned Trump by name publicly only at the beginning of April, suggesting that the president find an off-ramp to end the war. In Africa, the Pope has been speaking with much more firmly. In speeches this past week in Algeria and Cameroon, he warned that the whims of the world's richest threaten peace and decried violations of international law by neo-colonial global powers. Pope Leo is establishing himself as a moral leader for the global scale, said Bishop John Stowe of Lexington, Kentucky. Stowe, president of a U.S. Catholic peace organization, said Leo's recent messages carried more weight by being given during a visit to Africa, delivered face-to-face with the people who have lived with war, violence, famine, and chronic poverty. Popes have long been a moral voice on the global stage, loudly decrying situations of injustice, but they have also generally striven for the Church to remain neutral in world conflicts, allowing the Vatican to act as a mediator if asked to do so. It is a balance of roles that is difficult to maintain. Massimo Faggioli, an expert on the papacy, pointed to the example of Pope Pius XII, who directed clandestine networks to shelter Jews during the Holocaust, but is accused by some modern critics of not speaking loudly enough about the ongoing genocide. There is always the ghost of Pius XII hanging there, said Faggioli, a professor at Trinity College Dublin, referring to why Leo may be deciding to speak more forcefully now. I don't think he wants the Vatican to be accused of being soft on Trumpism because he's an American. Leo, the former Cardinal Robert Prevost, spent decades as a missionary, the bishop in Peru, before becoming pope. He lived there during an intense period of initial conflict between Peru's government and the Maoist guerrilla group Shining Path, when tens of thousands were killed in bloody warfare. In rural Peru, Prevost was immersed in what poverty, corruption, globalization of indifference, climate catastrophe, and governmental violence does to people, said Natalia Imperatore-Lee, an academic at Fordham University. He's uniquely qualified to speak about the dangers of political corruption and violence, she said. Pope Francis, Leo's predecessor, was from Argentina and was also known for forceful denunciations of conflict. He too clashed with Trump, who once called Francis disgraceful. With his recent comments, Thavis said, Leo may have spoken more forcefully than Francis or any other previous pope. Other popes, including John Paul II and Francis, have spoken about the dangers of ideological tyrannies and neocolonialism, said Thavis. And now our next article, companies scramble for tariff refunds. 56,000 importers await electronic refunds totaling $127 billion. Jay Foreman said he's locked and loaded for the U.S. government's Monday launch of a new system to refund up to $166 billion in illegally collected tariffs, but he and many other importers are realistic that much still could go wrong. You have to be worried about what they could possibly do to jam things up, said the CEO of toymaker Basic Fun, which sells Tonka trucks, Care Bears, and Connects construction toys. The refund system is the latest twist in a battle over tariffs collected over the past year as part of President Donald Trump's effort to restructure U.S. trade relations. The shifting tariffs roiled global business as companies rushed to shift supply chains to avoid the import taxes and figure out whom ultimately would pay the levies. In February, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the tariffs the Republican president pursued under a law meant for use in national emergencies. In a court filing this past week, U.S. Customs and Border Protection said it completed development of the initial phase of the refund system known as CAPE. It will consolidate funds so importers will get one electronic payment, with interest when applicable, rather than processing funds on an entry-by-entry basis. Critics of Trump's tariffs pushed for a streamlined process. A CPB spokesman said the agency created a system to efficiently process refunds pursuant to court order for importers and brokers who paid the duties. Customs officials said, as of April 9th, about 56,497 importers completed the steps necessary to receive electronic funds, an amount totaling $127 billion, or more than three-quarters of the total eligible to be refunded. More than 330,000 importers paid the tariffs at issue on 53 million shipments of imported goods, according to court filings. Matt Field, CFO of heavy truck maker Oshkosh, is one of them. The Wisconsin-based manufacturer doesn't disclose how much it paid in emergency tariffs, but Field said it's an impactful amount. He said he's prepared to file for refund as soon as the portal opens, but may wait for the system to settle. Several importers said they're concerned about the durability of the new filing system, at least in the opening phase as thousands rush to upload their claims. It's not like Taylor Swift tickets going on sale, said Basic Fund CEO Foreman, who seeks $7 million in refunds. But with so many companies looking for a refund at the same time, there's no telling if it crashes the portal. There are plenty of potential logistic glitches. It'll be nice to get that money back, said Jason Chung, CEO of Hunter Co., a U.S.-based toy maker with a factory in China. But he added, it looks like the government is trying to make it difficult. Chung noted registration requires entering bank account information, even though the government already has it for customs payments. Company names must be exact. It took me five tries before we could get registered due to minor differences like company versus co., he said. Still, he said, the company has no concerns about getting a refund. That sentiment was echoed by Rick Woldenberg, CEO of educational toymaker Learning Resources, one of the key plaintiffs in the court case that led to the tariffs undoing. There are wrinkles, of course, but I'm pleased to see the government do the right thing, he said. His company seeks more than $10 million. Refunds can be claimed by any company that is the legal entity that paid the taxes, so the issue reaches beyond U.S. borders. German fan manufacturer Empfast said it registered on the portal. But as the system is a new functionality created by U.S. Customs, it remains to be seen how well the system will actually handle the bulk processing of refund claims, a spokesman for the Mulligan-based company said. Companies are prepping claims so that they worry less about a last-minute Trump administration legal move that could slow the process. CBP has until early May to appeal the Court of International Trade's order requiring it to create the tariff refund portal. Our next article, Iran rebuffs Trump on new peace talks. President has said negotiations would resume Monday ahead of a ceasefire expiration. Iran rejected new peace talks with the United States, its state news agency reported on Sunday, hours after U.S. President Donald Trump had said he was sending envoys to Pakistan for talks and would strike Iran unless it accepted his terms. Iran stated that its absence from the second round of talks stems from what it called Washington's excessive demands, unrealistic expectations, constant shifts in stance, repeated contradictions, and the ongoing naval blockade, which it considers a breach of the ceasefire, Iran's official IRNA news agency wrote. Trump said Sunday the U.S. military took control of an Iranian-flagged cargo ship by blowing a hole in its engine room. "We have full custody of their ship and are seeing what's on board," he wrote on social media. The United States has kept a blockade of Iranian ports in place while Iran lifted and then reimposed its own blockade of a marine traffic through the Strait of Hormuz, which before the war began almost 2 months ago, handling roughly one-fifth of the world's oil supply. Iran's announcement that it would walk away from negotiations came after Trump said his envoys would arrive in Islamabad on Monday evening, one day before a two-week ceasefire ends. A White House official said the U.S. delegation would be headed by Vice President J.D. Vance, who led the war's first peace talks a week ago, and include Trump's envoy Steve Witkoff and son-in-law Jared Kushner. Trump separately told ABC News and MS Now that Vance would not go. The apparent diplomatic setback could set the stage for a renewed surge in oil prices when markets reopen after the weekend. Now in its eighth week, the war has created the most severe shock to global energy supplies in history, sending oil prices surging because of the de facto closure of the strait. Thousands of people have been killed by U.S.-Israeli strikes on Iran and in an Israeli invasion of Lebanon conducted in parallel since the war began on February 28th. Iran responded to the attacks with missiles and drones against its Arab neighbors that host U.S. bases. Iran's chief negotiator, Mohammed Bakr Khalibaf, said the two sides had made progress but were still far apart on nuclear issues and the strait. Pakistan has served as the main mediator, and Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif spoke by phone on Sunday with Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian. Sheriff's office said Pezeshkian had thanked Pakistan for its mediation efforts in a readout of the call that made no mention of Iran rejecting the next round of talks. European allies, repeatedly slammed by Trump for not aiding his war effort, worry that Washington's inexperienced U.S. negotiating team is pushing for a swift, superficial deal that would grab headlines but leave months or years of technically complex follow-up talks. Two liquefied petroleum gas tankers attempted to transit the strait on Saturday morning but made a U-turn after reaching waters south of Larak Island, marine traffic vessel tracking data showed. Iran's semi-official Tasnim news agency reported that the vessels were turned back by Iran's armed forces. One of the tankers, the Angola-flagged LPG tanker G. Summer, later exited the Gulf on the second attempt on Saturday evening, signaling China owner according to the data. Friday's announcement that the strait would reopen caused the sharpest one-day drop in oil prices in years and boosted stock markets to an all-time high. Amrita Sen, founder of the Energy Aspects think tank, predicted oil prices would rise on Monday when traders returned to their desks, having realized they might have been overly optimistic. Events over the weekend with Iran firing on merchant vessels and shutting the straits again highlight just how precarious the situation is, Sen said. Trump on Sunday also renewed his threat to hit Iran's power plants and bridges, continuing a pattern of such warnings throughout the war. He abruptly announced the ceasefire 2 weeks ago, just hours after declaring that Iran's whole civilization will die tonight. Iran has said that if the United States were to attack its civilian infrastructure, it would hit power stations and desalination plants of Gulf Arab neighbors. Pressure for a way out of the war has mounted on Trump as his fellow Republicans prepare to defend narrow majorities in Congress in the November midterm elections. With U.S. gasoline prices high, inflation rising, and his own approval ratings down. On Sunday, Pakistan appeared to be preparing for new talks. Two giant U.S. C-17 cargo planes landed at an airbase on Sunday afternoon, carrying security equipment and vehicles in preparation for the U.S. delegation's arrival, two Pakistani security sources said. Municipal authorities in the capital city of Islamabad halted public transport and heavy goods traffic through the city. Barbed wire was rolled out near the Serena Hotel, where last week's talks were held. The hotel told all guests to leave. Our next article, states await details on Medicaid work rules. The Trump administration's new law that Americans must work or volunteer to qualify for Medicaid health care benefits, set to take effect next year, has left states waiting for details on how to comply and with limited funding promised, according to six industry experts. The $200 million set aside for states to implement the work requirements in President Donald Trump's 2025 tax cuts and spending bill is expected to fall short of many states' needs, the industry experts said. In addition, detailed guidance to states and insurers who manage Medicaid benefits about who is exempt and what volunteer work qualifies is not expected until June. Unlike Medicare, for those ages 65 and older, which is fully funded by the federal government, costs of Medicaid for lower-income Americans are shared between the states and the U.S. government. With the law going into effect January 1st, some states may seek extensions and partially launch their systems, industry policy experts said. Matt Sallow, CEO of health consultancy Sallow Health Street, Strategics likened the rollout of the system to a soft opening of a restaurant. You're not going to see people get kicked off immediately, said Sallow, a former executive director of the National Association of Medicaid Directors. About 68 million people are enrolled in Medicaid plans, and nearly half are at risk of losing coverage, according to health policy firm KFF. The plans are managed by insurers such as United Health Group, CVS Health's Aetna, Allevance, Centene, and Molina. The launch may be messy for insurers, but the impact of the new policy on companies should even out over time, two investors and one analyst said. A spokesperson for the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services said the government has been distributing funds and is working with states on implementation. CMS has provided significant support to states, they said, and will continue to provide additional guidance through the interim final rule and ongoing engagement with states. Half of the funding is divided evenly across the 50 states, about $2 million per state, $2 million per state, while the other half is dependent on how many state residents are subject to the work requirements, the spokesman said. We'll take a short break now and return to the second half of the Decatur Herald and Review, dated Monday, April 20, 2026. Please stay tuned.